we cannot push back on Russia's claim or Canada's claim or anybody else's if we're not at the table.
Alaska's senators renew their push for ratification of the Law of the Sea Treaty. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, May 14th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, climate change brings increasing concerns about paralytic shellfish poisoning.
I eat them raw. I mean, when I'm on the beach, I have to have at least five. I just rinse them off in that scuzzy water.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
Leaders in Washington, D.C. are renewing the push to ratify a 30-year-old treaty known as the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. The treaty's passage could pave the way for expanded drilling in the Arctic Ocean. And as APRN's Peter Granitz reports, there's an odd assortment of groups pushing for it in the nation's capital.
Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman John Kerry says he'll hold hearings on the treaty soon. That comes just as Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Martin Dempsey are urging the Senate for ratification. The Law of the Sea, as it's known, has been signed by more than 160 countries. For all intents and purposes, it's a constitution for the ocean, with jurisdiction over piracy, shipping channels, and yes, deep-sea drilling. And because of its wide scope, it has an unlikely list of supporters, from environmentalists to oil and gas companies.
It is a welcome sight to see us holding hands as we move forward on an issue.
That's Robin Rorick. He's with the American Petroleum Institute, the lobbying association for the oil and gas industry. And he's talking about the environmentalists who see a UN treaty as an opportunity to regulate the potentially dirty offshore drilling industry. Rorick says the Law of the Sea would allow the United States to move further outward, beyond the current drilling restriction of 200 nautical miles off the coast. That means to the deeper and colder deep sea beds of the outer continental shelf. But without the treaty, oil companies are hesitant to do so.
Companies invest billions of dollars to operate offshore. You do not want to invest in an area where there are no rules or regulations, no certainty of operations. We can operate, sure. But it's almost like building a home somewhere where there are no laws, where there's nothing to govern you.
Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski has the task of convincing skeptical Republicans to sign on to the treaty. And she's got a pretty straightforward argument. Every day, the United States is not in the Arctic, preparing to tap into vast reserves of oil. Other countries are.
We cannot push back on Russia's claim or Canada's claim or anybody else's if we're not at the table.
Not all in her party seemed poised to join her. Conservatives in the Senate are circulating a letter of opposition. So far, it has more than 24 signatures. Treaties only go through the Senate, and they need 67 votes to pass, so that 25-vote block could prove to be a considerable force. The letter of opposition says the U.S. would sacrifice its sovereignty by signing on. That's an argument echoed by Stephen Groves. He's with the Conservative Heritage Foundation. He says the U.S., as a sovereign nation, has an inherent right to exploit the outer continental shelf. And by signing on to a UN treaty, the country could be forced to share some of its oil royalties with other nations.
Currently, the United States is not exposed to baseless international lawsuits, and currently the United States enjoys the right to explore and exploit deep seabed minerals without asking the permission of the International Seabed Authority.
The sovereignty argument is not new. In fact, it's one you often hear when the U.S. considers joining a United Nations effort. For his part, Senator Begich called opposition to the treaty on sovereignty grounds harebrained.
The problem is you have some members of the Senate that just believe in a conspiracy theory that somehow we're giving up our sovereignty, we'll lose our economic opportunity up there, and somehow people with blue hats will be running the Arctic in our territory.
Those blue hats are the trademark of United Nations peacekeepers across the globe. But if Senators Murkowski and Begich think they can get the magic 67 votes needed for ratification, they'll need to do so quickly. And if there's one indicator that has vote counters feeling optimistic the treaty could pass the Senate, it's just who Shell Oil brought on to lobby for it, Trent Lott. Lott, a former Senate Majority Leader, opposed the treaty when he was in office. Now, just 5 years later, he's pushing his old colleagues to pass it. To some, that may look like a typical Washington move, leaving office, then having a dollar-induced change of heart. But to others, it's a sign long-held opposition may be falling. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The state's spending plan for next year has been set as Governor Parnell today vetoed very little from the operating and capital projects budgets the legislature approved last month. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
In presenting his work to the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce, the governor praised lawmakers for agreeing early to stay within spending limits as he had requested. He also pointed to the state's various savings accounts, saying Alaska's in a very solid cash position.
Our permanent funds ended March with a value of $41.5 billion, the highest month-end closing value in its history. Our state rainy day fund, those budget reserves, have more than $15 billion in them. Remember that those budget reserves, those rainy day funds, they represent fully one-third of all 50 states' rainy day funds put together. That is financial strength.
The largest reduction of the $66.6 million the governor cut from spending was what he called an imprudent appropriation of $50 million to the Judicial Retirement Trust Fund. He said the required payments are already in the budget, and paying down the unfunded liability for just one of the state's retirement systems was not necessary. Legislators were generally satisfied with what the governor did and how little he rejected. Anchorage Democrat Hollis French said it showed an excellent working relationship between the governor and the House and Senate. And Anchorage Republican Liesl McGuire said it was important to recognize the two-way communication between legislators and the governor. Most criticism of the vetoes was a reduction the governor made to increases the legislature approved for pre-kindergarten programs. McGuire said those changes reflect a concern about the states getting more involved in local education. She says it was not a major dispute. This year's appropriation was just too high.
Many of us in the legislature do feel that, you know, putting dollars in that area is going to save you money on down the line when it comes to your corrections department, when it comes to your economic development opportunities and things that educating kids at a very young age seems to pay off for a society.
But Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra was more critical in his reaction. He says the state needs to do a better job educating young children.
One of the ways they estimate future prison beds is the reading level of kids in third grade. We rank 46th in the nation on third grade reading level. It's because we have one of the worst pre-K systems in the whole country. You know, Alaska is a pre-K backwater.
The governor did indicate a readiness to discuss ways to expand learning opportunities, but at a press availability following the speech, he made it very clear state intervention and parental responsibility does not automatically fall to the schools. The governor also signed a bill authorizing the public to decide whether to issue $453 million in general obligation bonds to pay for transportation projects around the state. He also approved a bill making final an overall increase in school funding, but changing the way the money is distributed to local school districts. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Some unemployed workers in Alaska are about to lose their unemployment insurance benefits thanks to federal legislation that ties the payments to a state's unemployment rate. Bill Kramer is chief of unemployment insurance for the State Department of Labor. He says Alaska's insured unemployment rate is below 6%, meaning residents are no longer eligible to file new claims for Tier 4 of the federal program. He says the federal changes include other provisions designed to encourage people collecting emergency unemployment insurance to find work.
It's mandated that they make an active job search every week and that unemployed workers document their job search, and we will audit certain numbers of those work searches that are made by people.
Congress implemented the Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program in 2008 as a way to extend benefits during the recession. It includes four tiers, varying from 6 to 20 weeks of additional payments. Kramer says about 1,900 Alaskans are currently receiving Tier 4 emergency unemployment compensation, while about 1,500 residents are claiming Tier 3. Existing claims will continue to be paid until they are exhausted. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, rural communities gather outside on a frigid spring day to prevent suicide.
I don't think I see anybody here that has not lost anybody to suicide. This is a very important walk.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Climate change is transforming the North as ocean waters warm. Fish and marine toxins normally seen down south find new habitat. And that's having a major impact on the people who gather wild food from the ocean, including Alaska Natives, who eat more wild protein than any other ethnic group in Alaska. So we're beginning our week-long look at how Natives are responding to warmer lands and waters by heading to a Cook Inlet beach at low tide. Johanna Urick has more.
Alaska Natives say when the tide goes out, the table is set. In Cook Inlet, it isn't just Natives out on the beaches. Many in south-central Alaska head to Clam Gulch each summer. One of those out there with her shovel and bucket is Mary Lou Butteroth, a Kenaitse tribal member.
I eat them raw. I mean, when I'm on the beach, I have to have at least five. I just rinse them off in that scuzzy water. And
but how safe are those razor clams? Mary Lou has never gotten sick, but anyone eating untested shellfish is taking a risk. Razor clams are relatively safe, but butter clams are the worst. They can hold PSP toxins up to 2 years. Cooking shellfish doesn't guard against PSP, though it reduces concerns about some marine toxins. More than 10 years ago, natives down the coast on Kodiak Island noticed that paralytic shellfish poisoning, or PSP, was increasing. It was happening more often, in places it hadn't before, and even in the winter when shellfish used to be safe. It wasn't just a little tingling in the mouth, either. Clams seemed more toxic. More people were getting sick. A Kodiak elder asked Bruce Wright, a biologist, for answers, but he didn't have any.
It's real quiet, and all the other elders are looking at him, and he goes, "For a scientist, you sure don't know very much, do you?" So I promised him I'd try.
The state only tests commercially grown shellfish. A decade later, he was working down the coast for the Aleutian Pribilof Islands in a region where people relied on clams and some had died eating toxic ones. He and Ray Rolon with the Alaska Sea Grant Marine Advisory Program tested clams throughout the state for a year. They trained people from the southern tip of Alaska to the islands on the Russian side of the Aleutian chain and north to the Pribilof Islands in the Bering Sea to prepare samples and put the word out on PSP, more commonly known as red tide. One of those trained was Desiree Roll, an Aleut in King Cove.
Prior to this project, it was like Russian roulette. We would wait for our neighbors to go eat the clams, and then if they were good, we'd go get our clams. Somebody had to be first.
That testing program resulted in the first and only statewide baseline on PSP in Alaska. It helped educate people in many communities about the risk of PSP, but it did not answer most of the questions asked by that Kodiak native more than a decade ago about why there seemed to be more problems with toxic clams.
Is there evidence that it's climate related? The problem that we have, particularly up here where we're at, is that we don't have enough data.
Ray Rolon with the Marine Advisory Program says with no data on what Alaska's shellfish was like in the past, it's hard to say if toxic levels are changing and why. Studies also indicate that most people who do get sick from eating shellfish don't bother to get tested. Toxic algae blooms increase with warmer ocean conditions and increased rainfall in calm waters. That much seems to be associated with climate. Rolland says that other marine toxins, which are a problem down south, will probably move north as conditions change. In 2004, a warm year, cruise ship passengers got sick eating oysters grown in Prince William Sound. It was Vibrio parahemolyticus, a toxic bacteria, something Rolland thought would never be a problem in Alaska's cold waters.
We had a record warm summer. One farm that was implicated in Prince William Sound had water that was 20 degrees centigrade. You could swim in it.
The 2004 outbreak was the third worst Vibrio event in the U.S. Rolland and his team went to work and found a way to keep commercial oyster farms out of hot water.
You just drop your gear for a few weeks, and it doesn't take very long.
The state put a Vibrio prevention program in place. That, along with existing PSP testing requirements, assures the safety of Alaska's commercially grown oysters. In the Aleutians, the network Wright and Rolland helped create continues to monitor clamming beaches and educate local residents about PSP. The state's also starting a pilot program for community monitoring. Those efforts may help increase the safety of clamming, which remains a risky business. I'm Johanna Urick.
The state's redistricting board made short work of its agenda today in Anchorage, voting unanimously to revise two Southeast Senate districts as ordered by the Alaska Supreme Court. The board voted to adopt Option A, which puts Skagway, Haines, and Juneau into Senate District P, and Petersburg, Wrangell, Ketchikan, and Prince of Wales Island into Senate District Q. The board also voted unanimously to include the changes in its amended proclamation plan, which is destined to go back to the state Supreme Court for final approval. Mike White is the board's attorney.
We have to file it by noon tomorrow with them. They've already ordered that the amended proclamation plan, the new plan that the board drafted, with these new Southeast districts, is going to be the interim plan for 2012. So for 2012, we're going to use this plan. Yet we asked the Supreme Court to just simply take it, since you have the same information as the Superior Court, and rule on those objections.
White says challenges to the plan still remain before state Superior Court, and the outcome of that issue is still up in the air.
So it could be that this plan is the plan for the rest of the decade. It could be that the board will need to come back and do some more work. We just don't know that yet.
Petersburg leaders were happy to see the redistricting board's latest changes to the legislative lines in Southeast Alaska. It's the only Southeast municipality that had challenged the board's previous redistricting plans, which originally put Petersburg into a new district with Juneau. Petersburg City Clerk Kathy O'Rear.
We're pleased. It puts us with communities that we have much more in common with than the original proposal by the board.
Petersburg is primarily a fishing town and had argued that it didn't have enough in common with Juneau, which is more dependent on government and tourism.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
A native healthcare organization in Anchorage is transforming the way it does business with a Toyota management system. Chugachmute delivers health care and social services to seven Alaska Native villages around Prince William Sound. Executive Director Patrick Anderson says the Toyota lean management style has helped the organization free up resources to spend on improving care. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Spring cleaning is a well-established ritual for many people in their homes, but at work, it isn't as common, unless you work for Chugachmute, like Jerry Lucan.
A lot of the stuff will get tossed or recycled.
Lucan is participating in a lean improvement event. Employees are spending 2 days cleaning and organizing their offices and common spaces. One of the main tenets of lean is continuous improvement, whether that's clearing clutter, streamlining the hiring process, or fixing a payroll error. At Toyota, that means every worker can stop the production line as soon as they see a problem develop. That ensures a small defect won't be repeated on hundreds of cars. At Chugachmute, Lucan says the concept works too.
You feel empowered to like try to fix something if it's not working, you know. Our travel forms don't work. You know, what can we do about it? Instead of just saying like, all right, our travel forms don't work, I go on with my life and just deal with it. It takes time and energy when something's not working to go around it, to work with it instead of just fixing it.
You wouldn't think a system developed for a car company with thousands of employees would work for a small native organization that provides healthcare and social services for 2,200 customers. But as soon as Chugachmute Executive Director Patrick Anderson heard about Lean in 2004, he saw the potential. In his office, he has two shelves full of Lean advice books promoting the management style for every industry, including healthcare.
I studied. All those books have been read. They don't just sit on my shelf to impress people. I've read them. But as I read them, I realized that this could be the answer to a well-run organization.
But Anderson says the transition to Lean wasn't easy. He describes it this way.
Monstrous. Monstrous.
Many employees welcomed the new style, but he met heavy resistance from some, especially in the healthcare division. In 2007, the entire medical provider staff, 5 employees, resigned in part because of the transition to Lean. Those former employees did not want to be interviewed for this story. But in an email, one former physician's assistant said Lean did not improve clinical outcomes. He wrote the management style focused relentlessly on revising standards at the expense of patient care. And in the process, the art of medicine was lost. But Anderson thinks Lean can work anywhere.
A lot of people tell me, well, we can't use a management system for a car company in a hospital. We do things differently. And I say, no, you don't do things differently. Your management system comes from Ford and General Motors.
More and more healthcare organizations around the country are starting to adopt Lean. Hospitals like Seattle Children's and Virginia Mason were among the first. Anderson would like to see others follow. He thinks it's one solution to the unsustainable rise in healthcare costs. That's because eliminating waste is such a big focus of Lean. Anderson wants every worker to do their job as efficiently as possible. For example, if a worker spends a lot of their day making copies, he makes sure they sit near a copier so they don't waste time walking.
There are thousands and thousands and thousands of these in every organization. But people don't think that way. I do. I think about every little minute that can be applied to more productive use.
Anderson says it's difficult to calculate an exact amount Lean has saved Chugachmute each year, but he says the management style has helped the organization trim costs.
We don't just put it into a piggy bank somewhere. We have services to provide. One example is that we freed up a lot of money for our dental program. We have 2 villages now that are cavity-free among all of the adults, and our 2 other villages are pretty darn close, probably 60-80%. Of the way. That's unheard of in a village.
Anderson thinks Lean will help Chugachmute free up even more resources in the years ahead. In the meantime, it's freeing up space on Jerry Lucan's desk.
Notes. So.
Lucan picks up a batch of old papers and tosses them in the recycle pile, and a section of desk he hasn't seen in a long time suddenly reappears. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Despite years of effort and millions of dollars in state campaigns, Alaska's suicide rate remains at nearly double the nation's average. On Saturday, communities across the state participated in suicide prevention walks and gatherings. Len Anderson attended the event in Kotzebue and filed this report.
I don't think I see anybody here that has not lost anybody to suicide. This is a very important walk.
Rosie Hensley, general manager of Public Radio KOTZ in Kotzebue, was watching people registering for LifeWalk 2012. Her station participated heavily in the event through advanced announcements and public affairs programs, as well as phone reports on Saturday itself from regional village observances. It was a heavy commitment for the station, but as Hensley noted and Walter Sampson told the crowd just before the walk began, it was justified.
Our region, the Banana region, has 66.7 rate. We're the second highest in the state. We need to find a way to change that.
Nome has the highest rate with 67.7 suicides in a calculated 100,000 population index. Sampson said the unsuccessful attempts of the past do indicate a key to a possible future reduction in the region's suicide numbers.
We've attempted to get some help, both from the state and the federal side. Somebody from the outside is unable to fix that. So we ask people need to work on their own.
Like last year, the Life Walk theme was Live, Laugh, Love. In Kotzebue, the life-affirming slogan was proclaimed on signs and by the attitude of the participants, who donned bright white T-shirts over coats prior to setting off under sullen gray skies, temperatures in the mid-20s, and a chilly west breeze off the frozen sound.
My name is Queen Davis. It might not be nice, but it's a good day for a walk.
You're challenged by crutches right now.
Yeah, my arthritis has kind of got bad, but God still walk, keep moving, think positive. Thank God they have a bus in case can't make it all the way, you know.
About 150 people made the trek, which ended with an indoor picnic featuring, among other things, hamburgers, hot dogs, and muktuk. There was also live music, some state dignitaries, and personal testimony, including from State Representative Reggie Jewell of Kotzebue.
I was home rummaging through some stuff, and I looked at my sister's pictures, and I had good memories, as well as some painful ones.
Jewell lost his sister to suicide.
We're here in part because of the pain, but a large part so that other people don't have to experience it, and to be supportive and hopeful.
Hensley agreed.
People that are thinking of committing suicide, if they see somebody walking in the events like this, maybe they can go to that person, try to get that hand that can help them think of not committing suicide.
In Kotzebue, this is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Johanna Urich in Anchorage, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, and Len Anderson in Kotzebue. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory.
And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers competitive interest rates with programs tailored for first-time homebuyers and home choice seminars that cover the details of purchasing and financing a home. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.